Hello and welcome to Messiah's Upper Room Podcast. Each week, you'll join Messiah's Upper Room Bible Study Class led by Pastor Jim Oddie. This week, we continue our series over the Gospel of John. Enjoy.
I have this really great article that is came out of CPH. You know what CPH is? Yeah, Concordia Publishing House. It's the LCMS publishing house. Anyway, they put together a blog that is available. Thank you, Mike, for anybody that would want to read it. And the article, this article in particular, was written by a friend of mine who's a black pastor in Iowa. He is the assistant to the president of the Iowa West District. And he wrote this article called "The Real Enemy Feeding Racism in America." This is a really good article. Keith is he's an LCMS pastor, and I've known him probably for 25, maybe 30 years. So long time, solid guy. And he's talking about that the emphasis on racism right now in America is a symptom rather than a cause. And again, we would say that from a Christian spiritual perspective, we kind of look at things a little bit differently maybe than necessarily the world might do that. He's acknowledging that that racism does exist. He's not saying it doesn't. He doesn't put it in the category of being quite as systemic as is being promoted, okay? But that the real enemy feeding racism in America is spiritual warfare. Is that he really believes that, and many of us do, that what has been feeding this all along and then now has erupted and sort of exploded in a national way and certainly in a very public way, is that it's really a spiritual thing as opposed to simply a societal thing or a cultural thing. So anyway, I'm going to just leave this out here. If anybody wants to take a picture of it on your phone and then access it, you can access it through Concordia Publishing House. But it's really well written. It's written from a conservative Lutheran perspective. So, you know, that's the little disclaimer here. And I say it that way because there are people that are not conservative, but conservatively biblical Lutherans. There's also liberal biblical Lutherans as well. So there is that wide spectrum, okay? And you're going to get that wide spectrum, even though very often in the news media, Lutheran is all lumped together, all right? They'll say, well, Lutheran's this, Lutheran's that, and Missouri Synod people look at that and they go, well, that isn't our brand, you know. And so we tend to be more conservative in our approach toward the Bible and then also society and the role of Christians in the world, et cetera. Okay, so anyway, I just put this out here for those of you that would like to access that. And then if you want to access it and then have a conversation about it, I would invite you to do that. I am not necessarily advocating the idea that you should have the conversation on Facebook. It's very difficult. No, I would love to, but it's very difficult to do that unless you're in a closed group of some kind. It's very difficult to do that and not have either people that you don't know or people that you do know jump in and hammer you, and then it distracts from the thing you're trying to do. And I'm kind of learning that the hard way. So, because I want to engage in some way, but I don't want to end up getting screamed at on Facebook. I can't connect very well with people when I feel like I'm just being constantly lectured or constantly told that whatever I'm doing is wrong. So if you want to have that conversation with me, the best way to do it with me is this or this, but to do it where it's just the two of us or maybe a close group of us, okay, something like that. I'm not afraid to do things on Facebook or other social media because I do it, but I'm learning that you get distracted off the main thing. And then once you get distracted off the main thing, then you're not on the main thing anymore. Okay? So anyway, for what it's worth. And some of you are quite engaging on Facebook. Not to look at anybody in particular here, right? Yeah.
It's hard have to wade through the four-letter words when you get on.
Yeah, it just is. I mean, I've kind of made a public statement about that. That's, to me, vulgar and degrading. And I understand that there's a lot of emotion behind that when people say it, but I also think that it's kind of becoming a habit, and it's just like any other word in people's minds. Mostly, it's an angry word, if we're talking about all the same word here we're talking about, okay? That F-bomb word. And so it's not that I don't understand it or the emotion behind it. I just think that in the public discourse, particularly among Christians and people that represent more than just themselves or forget that they do, words matter. I think words matter. And so if that comes back to me in that form, I'm not going to engage with it. It doesn't do any good to tell people not to do it, because some people go, oh yeah, well, I'll see year one and raise you 10. And see, then that, what does that do? That shuts everything down. And it particularly shuts me down. So I'm just not going to engage in that if it goes to that level. Yeah.
Could you give me the title again?
Do what? Why don't I just give you the thing and you can take a picture? Do you have a camera that takes a picture?
If we take a picture, okay, we will need to get an electron microscope to read it.
You have one of those untraceable phones right there. That's
yes.
Good.
And you can actually turn it off for real.
You can turn it off for real, yeah.
You can't do that.
Yeah. So that's good. Those are, I don't know anybody else that I know of that has one of those. That's kind of an antique, isn't it? Yeah, flip phone. You have a flip phone? Yeah, Phil.
If I can find the link to that article, I'll just post it in the podcast show notes with this.
Oh, that'd be great. Yeah, that'd be great. That way then we could have a conversation here if you want to. We can do that. I don't mind it here, even though what we talk about here doesn't stay in here, you know. I mean, you know, okay. I mean, but the context is good. It's okay. That's okay. We can do that here if you'd like to do that. But I'd like us to do it. Have the conversation from a fairly common or at least a unified thing that we're all talking about that article rather than we're all, just talking about it from just our own perspective. I want it kind of run through a filter if we can do that. Okay, does that make sense?
Yeah.
You good with that? Okay, good. All right, very good. Well, let's get into our lesson for today. What I did for today, because I kind of felt that last week, the usual thing is we don't get done with the whole lesson, so then we have to start at the last part of the one before. And I did that on purpose here, but I kind of want us to get into the thought again of what I have up on the board, which is the chart that has two columns in it. And we were kind of talking last week about people or situations that in which it's easy to keep on loving, and then situations where it's hard to keep on loving. And I was thinking about this after class, which of course means that I was thinking about this during late service while I was in late service, right? I'm not going to go on the podcast and say when in the service I was thinking about those things, right? But, you know, my mind goes wherever it goes. But what had occurred to me is that there may be a third position. And that always feels better to me to say that there is, because I don't like the idea that it could only be this or this, you know, that there's only two choices. But there might be actually a point in which you're starting to move toward thinking that the person or the situation you're with is hard to love, and then you would have sort of a pause in there where you could think to yourself, uh-oh, I'm going down the path, and can I reverse myself and come back the other way? So my question to you is really kind of that, along those lines, is are you able to tell in yourself when you're changing your view towards someone that maybe where it starts out that, yeah, boy, this is really great. We have this thing going. It's awesome. This person, I really like this person, and I really love this person. And it's easy to keep on loving this person. And then you can feel in yourself when it's starting to shift and you're starting to move over into feeling like maybe this isn't such an easy person to love, and maybe you're starting to feel a little bit like you're going to be a bit resistant to loving that person or treating that person in a loving way. Can you tell that in yourself? If you can, what do you notice in yourself? We're having a little sort of therapy session here, so just go ahead and feel free to say what you need. Yeah.
Okay.
That you can tell. That's what happens for you, is right, is you start to pull away a little bit. Okay, that could be one sign of it. Yeah, Phil?
Sometimes I get a little bit shorter in my dealings with that person.
Yeah.
If I do have like a face-to-face interaction with them or online or something like that.
Sure, yeah. I find it for myself the same thing. I get a little bit, let's see, what would the word be? Less patient, I suppose, you know, less understanding, whatever. Yeah.
A little curt.
A little curt. Or could be a lot of curt, Phil. Could be. You know, little and lot is in the eye of the receiver, not in the eye of the beholder. All right, yes, that's right.
Sometimes it goes the other way. Sometimes you have a conversation with someone that you think, oh, we don't see eye to eye on anything.
Yeah.
And if you start learning why they are where they are,
yeah,
and they get to hear why you're where you are,
mm-hmm,
sometimes I think that middle place is a good place. Maybe you'll never, you'll never see eye to eye in one,
right,
place, but the old iron sharpens iron.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes talking to other people clarifies your position and,
yeah,
even to yourself.
Yeah, the problem with iron sharpens iron is that sometimes you're going to get cut by it when you're, if I can do it out here. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, no, that's exactly right. Yeah. Yeah, Peggy?
She's saying, I have a friend who admitted this recently, that she had an opinion of this person just from sort of a distance and being around the person for a long time, but not really getting to know the person.
Yeah.
Then she had opportunity to work with the person,
mm-hmm,
and said that,
mm-hmm,
I really do like her.
Yeah.
She didn't before. She didn't think she did. She didn't do some of the things, the way she conducted things.
Mm-hmm.
And so then it was, once she got involved with her,
right,
I really liked her.
Yeah.
She's different than I thought she was.
So, see, it was the movement toward the person with a little bit more of an open mind, maybe, or just getting to know that person. Yeah. Sometimes I think the things that we look at and we think, oh, I just don't want to be around that person, or oh, I just don't like that person, is so narrow because we don't know the big story. We don't know the full story. Okay. So that's a good point. Well, anyway, I just thought I would let you know that during the second service, I'm often thinking about many things. Okay. And so we just think about that from that perspective, that very rarely is it an either or, but it's a movement from one to the other. And if you can think in terms of, even from the perspective, as Peggy pointed out, initially it was a person over here, right? And then they allowed some movement to come over here, and it isn't just necessarily hard and fast. And I think that's one of the things that was the takeaway for me in terms of John 13, 34 to 35. So I put that up, put it back in your outline for today, where Jesus says, "A new commandment I give you, that you love one another. Just as I have loved you, you are also to love one another. By this, all people will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another." And as we talked about last time, the original language here is not that it's the love in the sense of feeling that could be there, but it's more of the action of loving. And it's an ing, it's a keep on. So it's not even like a one-shot thing. Like a lot of times people say that, well, I did love you once. It's not like that. It's that there's a maintenance to it. There's a sustainability to it. that we keep on doing it, and that's what Jesus is talking about. And so the kind of prayer that you might want to pray when you find yourself over here in the hard to keep on loving with somebody else, or you're even over here in the easy to keep on loving, but you're starting to feel yourself drift just a little bit, all right, is to pray the prayer, Lord, teach me how to keep on loving, and then fill in the blank. Because I think the reality is that there are some people that are easy to love and some people that are hard to love. There just is, right? But if you're in a work set situation or a family situation or even in a church situation, hard to believe even in a church situation that I would say that, right? Because everybody's personality is different and we all react differently to different things. Is, Lord, teach me how to keep on loving. That sort of implies, that prayer implies that part of the problem in the loving department might be me. See, as opposed to what this, and I did this on purpose with you, is that the focus of making the chart was on other people. And if only other people wouldn't be the problem, it would be much easier to love them, right? I mean, that isn't that kind of where we go with that? But that's not at all where Jesus is coming from, and we're going to see that in our lesson for today. Yeah.
In the Purpose-Driven Life, which is one of my favorite books,
yeah,
Paul Warren talks about EGR people, extra grace required.
EGR?
EGR people.
We all went through that book, but I didn't remember that one part.
And that as Christians.
Let's put that up here. I was going to put it over there, but I thought, well, that's kind of bad.
No, I think they belong in the middle.
Right here. Extra.
Extra grace required. And as Christians.
Here, will you hold that for me? Thank you.
We need to be responding to these hard to keep on loving people with grace and love. Too often we want to run the other way or ignore them or not have anything to do with it.
You know, it's interesting that you say that because in that article that, wherever it went, how many of you have read C.S. Lewis's book, The Screwtape Letters? He references that in there. That would be a good read sometime for somebody because what he talks about in there and the references in the article is that in the gist of the Screwtape Letters is that, who is it, Wormwood or Screwtape is the father, devil, and Wormwood is his son. I forget how it goes exactly. But anyway, the whole deal of the book, the little book, is that the devil is talking to his son or to his associate and sending him down to the earth in order to work the people up to where Satan can do his bidding, okay? And so that's the whole spiritual warfare idea. But what he talks about in there is that one of the things that the devil is most interested in, he will sacrifice everything else for the sake of the one thing. And the one thing is to get Christian hearts to become indifferent. If we can become indifferent to each other, indifferent to the gospel, indifferent to things going on in the world, that he will then have exactly what he needs in order to do his bidding. And what you just said, Marian, is so true, is that what happens is, in what that means in indifference is that I now can blind myself to your life. I can be unaffected by it. I can see it. I can witness it. I can even sit down and talk with you about it. And then after talking with you about it, I can walk away and be unaffected. That's what indifference is. Very intriguing. And so his argument in the article is that so much of what's gone on societally and culturally as it relates to racism has been, a lot of it has been due to the fact that we sort of have hardened our own hearts in that sense, is that we see it, but we don't see it. We hear it, but we don't hear it. And we're unaffected by it. Until what? Until somebody starts making enough noise and now it gets our attention. Now, the way that people are getting making noise isn't good either. But at the same time, the degree of indifference has sort of numbed us out to the plight of people. And so that I think that's a message we're thinking about. I think it's something for us to look at ourselves and say, okay, in what way might I be contributing, which includes that maybe extra grace required starts with the extra grace that I need as opposed to the extra grace that other people might need because my eyeballs are only facing you. They're not, you know, facing me. Something to think about. So anyway, and I really hope that you'll read that article and be and that you'll react to it. And I would love to have a conversation with anybody about that. Yeah, Richard?
Actually, we're talking about signs that we're making that transition.
Oh, yeah. In yourself? Yeah.
I think about indifference.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, you know, when someone expresses some concern, whatever it is, and we're satisfied with giving them a short answer.
A short answer?
A phrase.
Yeah. The pat answer kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The pat answer.
Mm-hmm.
We're going down that road.
Yeah, I think we are. Now, I will also say that I think that the overall level now of anxiety is making it harder and harder to be receptive to anybody. That's one of the things that's happening, too. And that's not just the political stuff, although that's part of it. The racial stuff is part of it. The COVID stuff is part of it. I mean, there's like, it's like not one thing, but it's six things, and they're all big things. And they're all things that everybody in the U.S. has an opinion about, and they don't mind sharing it. And so then there's the weight of that, okay? And so to some degree, there is a difference, I think, emotionally between being indifferent and just being tired. So the more that you try to absorb and the more that you try to care about and the more that you have compassion for, all those kinds of things, end up, you know, after a while, you got to pick one. Which one is it going to be? Now, what is capping? Do you know what I'm asking? Do you know the question? Did you see the congratulations on Facebook for the two of you? And it said, your picture was on it, so I figured it was both of you. And it said, congratulations for capping. And I thought, okay, capping oil wells, capping. So what is capping?
At Keller Williams, you'd have to pay a percentage of your commission
to
Keller Williams.
Yeah.
Until you pay in your cap.
Yeah.
And when you've done that, you've capped, and then you get 100% of your commission.
Okay, I guess I now know
so
what you're...
So on closing statement, when it says a realtor gets all this money...
Oh, yeah.
The realtor doesn't get all that money.
Oh, okay, because we're refinancing our house, so that would be part of that. Okay.
Yes, so it goes to Keller Williams.
Well, thank you for clarifying that. I saw it on Friday, and it's been bothering me ever since, so I thought, boy, if they're here today, I'm gonna ask them. Yeah, okay, I got it. Great. Okay, so... What? Do what?
If you need a realtor, by the way.
Because now I've capped and my year has started over.
Oh, it did? Okay.
So it's not really great when you cap on the last.
So are you like the promotional person and she does all the work? Is that kind of what that
card.
Is?
Security detail. I'm
still security.
Construction company, but then I also help her show houses.
When I don't know the people.
That's very nice. Thank you. You've actually given me way more information than I wanted, but actually we're good. Yeah, well, that was my fault. I just couldn't leave well enough alone on that one. All right, so let's look at the list here because I think it is pertinent when you think in terms of how did Jesus keep on loving with people that at least culturally were hard to love. I don't know necessarily that we would say from Jesus' point of view this is a person hard to love, although he was human. And as a human, you know, I got my limits, okay? So we kind of put that in the area of hard to love, but, you know, still he's like the Son of God. Okay, so how did Jesus keep on loving the condescending scribes and Pharisees? Oh, look at that, condescending right there. Of all the judgmental people, there were a ton in his life. And the scribes and the Pharisees, or just we could say the organizers of the organized religion. We could say it that way if you think of the way people talk about that today. So how did he How did he keep on loving them? Or how did he?
He kept interacting with them.
Yes. Phil, you were going to say that too?
Well, I was going to say he was just very patient with them.
Yeah. I mean, he got progressively less patient with them. I mean, because how long was he doing this? 3.5 years. Well, 3 7/8 years. So, and they were following him around. It wasn't like he had to go look for them. So they would be sort of like the piety police, right? And every time he did something on the Sabbath that they didn't like, boy, they were all over him, right? And yet he continued to engage with them. So that says something about a way to keep on loving. Now, none of us is the Son of God, so it might take little less than 3 7/8 years, okay? All right, what about this? The abusive Roman soldiers at his crucifixion. How did he keep on loving them? Hmm? Yeah, how do you know? What'd he say? Father, forgive them. For what reason? They don't know what they're doing. So he's forgiving them even though their intent was off, their actions were terrible, right? But he forgives, right? That's very interesting. The zealots, these were the anarchists who sought to overthrow the government. That's nothing new, by the way. People say, oh, Antifa, how terrible. Well, they had that back in Jesus' day, right? The zealots, they were all about, I think that I read somewhere that, and Bob, you can sort of correct me on this if I'm wrong, but the word zealot meant hidden knife, something like that, where, you know, you keep a knife under your cloak, and anytime you're near a soldier or, you know, anybody in authority, stick them, you know, kind of idea. That was what they were all about. So how did he keep on loving them?
He recruited one of
them. Who? Simon the Zealot. So he invited one of them to come into his close circle, right? The other thing I'm thinking of is that he continued to define the kingdom. See, the zealots said the way the kingdom looks is no Romans, no authority, no police, nothing, which everybody's going to love each other and then it'll be all fine. And we'll all get along. And Jesus, you're going to be the one to set that up here on earth. And what did Jesus keep saying over and over and over again? My kingdom is not of this world. Yes, we're engaged in warfare, but it's a whole different deal. It's spiritual, it's deeper, and it's not to be ignorant of Roman abuses, okay? There was a lot of Roman abuses in those days. It's not ignorant of that. But it's to keep saying that fixing that will not fix the problem. And that's a message I think is needed for today. We can fix things, but that doesn't fix the problem. The problem is at a deeper and more core level. Okay, what about to keep on loving Peter, who eventually denied him? How did he keep on doing that?
He forgave him like 3 times.
He forgave him, and then what did he do after he forgave him? He invited him back into the feed my sheep, feed my lambs, feed, you know, that you're still in the mission. See, he could have easily said, boy, you crossed the line. I'm done with you. He could have done that. He could have forgiven him, but not invited him back in, right? But he still had plans for Jesus, and that was a way that he could continue to love him. The Jewish money changers in the temple courts, how did Jesus keep on loving them?
He got their attention.
Flipped a few tables. Yeah. I've seen this kind of analogy painted for the protests and the looting and all that stuff today, linking it to this and saying, well, Jesus went and he disrupted things. He tipped things over. He did all that stuff. So the question you always want to ask is, what did he do after that? What did he do after that? Yeah, he went in the temple and prayed. So if you're going to engage in attention-getting sort of stuff, and you're going to keep the main thing, right, then somewhere in there, your spirituality has to be recaptured. Okay? Something worth thinking about. All right, two of them here regarding the Samaritans, all right? So how did he keep on loving the Samaritans who were oppressed by the Jews?
How'd he do it?
See, there's no love lost between the Jews and the Samaritans. In fact, they sort of were divvied off to live in a different part of the area, because if they lived together in the same thing, they would be throwing rotten tomatoes at each other all the time, okay? So how did Jesus keep on loving the Samaritans who were oppressed by the Jews? We studied it in the gospel, what in our study. What did he do, Dan? Yeah, he went over there where no other Jew would want to do that. He went over there, and then what did he do when he was there, Bob?
He met the woman at the well.
So even more, he's talking to a woman, a Samaritan woman. Yeah.
And he also treated the Syrophoenician woman in Galilee.
I would not say he was colorblind. I think he was very aware. But he refused to let that do what? Stop him from engaging.
Because he put them in one of the best known parables.
Do what?
He put a Samaritan in one of the best known parables.
I know. And we all walk away going, man, there's no way. I mean, we would, because it's not a Samaritan issue for us. But if you think in terms of who is the person in America today that you would say is the least likely to help somebody else who's in need? Whoever that is, that's who the Samaritan is. That's right. And not different, yeah, but despised by me. See, that's why he went. So it's whoever in your mind is, oh my gosh, there's no way I could ever respect or like that person, because that person represents everything that I absolutely hate. That's a person. Jesus is so cool. All right, what about the next one? The Samaritans, who in turn despised their oppressors. See, it isn't just that the Samaritans were the victim. What they did was they said, well, we'll just turn our victimhood around into hating you. So, see, that didn't solve the problem. So how did Jesus keep on loving people who despised his own people? How did he do it? What did he do? What was the thing he did after he talked to the Samaritan woman at the well? What did she do? She went and did what? She went and got all her friends and said, oh, you got to see this guy. He's amazing. And he even talked to me. And he's a Jewish guy. Amazing. So then they all came to see Jesus. So then what happened then? Remember? Clearly you don't remember. What happened? What happened? He stayed extra days because they all heard what he had to say. And they said, oh, we cannot get enough of this. Will you stay? And he said, yes. So it wasn't even like a one-shot deal, meeting on the bus, you know, never see you again. It wasn't like that. He engaged, and he stayed with it, and he engaged with the gospel. This is the thing I think that sometimes we miss. He didn't stay with them and lecture them on how terrible they are treating people or pitying them for how other people are treating them. There's too much of that going on today. He shared his love for them. And in doing so, he was sharing the very gospel of salvation and saying to them, you're included in the kingdom, which was not going on in the minds of Jewish people. Samaritans were out because they weren't true Jews. They had, you know, back in their history, they had intermarried with the Babylonians and the Persians and all that. Well, of course, that went on everywhere. But that was being held against them, and that's why they were considered half-breed. They were not considered true Jews. And so they, feeling victimized and oppressed by the Jews, said, we're not going to have any of that. And so they, in turn, just said, well, we'll victimize the Jews. We'll hate them. So see, Jesus takes everything to a deeper level. Okay, what about the other disciples who slept when Jesus needed them in Gethsemane, and then they all ran away when he was arrested? How did he keep on loving them? Did you know that they did that? Yeah, that's what they did. So, you know, how did Jesus keep on loving them?
He died for their sins.
Thank goodness. And then finally, how did Jesus keep on loving St. Paul when his name was Saul? And he intentionally helped to kill Stephen. He was accessory. He didn't just put his knee on Stephen's neck. He held the coats and picked up the rocks. How did Jesus keep on loving Saul?
Is Stephen the only one besides Jesus in Scripture that asked that his enemies be forgiven when they were stoning
him? She's asking if Stephen was the only one in the Bible who, when he was getting killed, said, "Father, forgive them." Yeah. I think so. Yeah.
Paul was standing there.
Yeah.
Helping.
Yeah. But yeah, I think so. But what's interesting about that was that Paul, at that time, as Saul, was such a zealot for the Jewish faith that what Stephen said and what was happening to Stephen was, he felt totally justified in that. Right? I mean, we've talked before about hardening of one's heart in the sense of that if you feel like that your cause is just and you don't have any sort of other way of sort of checking yourself at the door, then you can easily justify anything you do and say, well, I can do this because. And that's what, so that's why it took Jesus to do what? To keep on loving Saul. So how did he keep on loving Saul? What did he do to Saul?
He did an intervention.
It was a direct intervention. Direct intervention. So he knocks him down. Then he blinds him for 3 days. And then he drags him off and makes him go sit at the feet of a teacher who's a Christian. You know, gosh, that would have been great. And then he converts him. And then he does what? He commissions him. So you wonder who in our world today, our society today, that some of what's going on is in fact not a way that God is doing the same thing. Interesting. Yeah. Thoughts?
I was going to ask, would it be fair to say that Jesus disciplined Saul?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he whacked him. You know that game, Whack-A-Mole? There's a lot of that going on. Yeah, I mean, you could say that. But again, this was a case where it was a direct thing. And what it's thought, you know, because he spent 3 days blinded and nobody really knows, like, what, I mean, he was literally blinded. But, you know, later he talks about his thorn in the flesh. That story in 2 Corinthians. So a lot of people think that somehow that thorn in the flesh was some physical ailment that was connected to the blindness that he suffered. And it might have been something like that. We don't know. Because the blinding occurred when? When he was blinded by the light. Yeah, that was it. So, you know, it was just that flash, and that could well have been something that lasted for longer than just that period of time. Okay? All right, so does this make sense? It's thinking about from the perspective of, yes, there are people hard to love. There are times when I'm hard to love. I know, hard to believe, but it just is. I know Victoria's not here today, so I don't have to worry about what she thought about that statement. But but we all have our moments when we are.
She would probably say, "I love you anyway."
She would. Yes, she would. So I'm going to hang on to that thought all through the second service. That'll be here. Oh, and then the last one. Look at that. What word did I put in there? You. You. See, at any given time, any of us is this plus some, right? And yet Jesus says, "Yeah, I know you're that way. Okay, but I want you still to be part of me." And being part of me, I want you to still be in the mission, and I want you to still keep doing that. And there might be times when he goes, "Oh, what was I thinking?" You know, or heavy sighing from Jesus. All right, might be. But he says, "I'm going to keep on loving you." Okay, the other verse that we looked at but hardly spent any time on is in John 14:6. Now, that came after this part, and this is where they had this conversation about Jesus saying that, you know, I go to prepare a place for you, and where I'm going is this many mansions kind of idea. Many rooms is what this translation said. And then Thomas goes, well, Lord, you know, how do we even know where to go? Because we don't know where you're going. And, you know, that whole sort of rationalistic perspective that Thomas took. And so then he says, I don't know the way. We don't know where you're going, and we don't know the way. And then that's when Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. What's interesting about that interchange is that Thomas was thinking directionally. In other words, I don't know where Jesus is. Jesus says he's leaving, and I don't know where he's going, but he tells me I know the way. Well, how can I know the way if I don't know where you're going? I mean, that makes perfect sense from a directional point of view, right? But then Jesus points out that he's not talking directionally, he's talking relationally. And that when you think of it from a relational perspective, it's not where you go, it's with whom you are. And that's the beauty of it, even when you think from the perspective of death and then resurrection, and where is heaven, and am I there, and do I know it, and does other people know? I mean, all those questions we always ask. But the Bible approaches it not from a where perspective. It's not a directional perspective. What? Heaven's up and hell is down. I mean, we all sort of grew up with that. And then we got old enough to realize that there's people on the other side of the globe. And if they're looking up, they're looking at us. I mean, how do you do that? So it was never directional. It's relational. And that's what Jesus is talking about when he says, I am the way, the truth. So to sort of get a sense of that, we go back to some other teachings in John where he talked about himself as the gatekeeper of the sheepfold. We talked about how, you know, in the wilderness, the shepherds, they didn't have a corral. So what did they do? They pulled together these brambles, these sharp-edged branches, and they would make a corral out in the middle of nowhere. And then all the sheep go in, and then they have a sort of a gate thing, not really a gate like we think of, but it's just a bunch of other branches, and they put them all in the opening, and then nobody gets in or out. And the guy who opens it or shuts it is the gatekeeper, right? So what did Jesus say? I am the gatekeeper. That's what he's saying here, is that the way you get in and stay in is through me. And so just some notes here for you. Jesus reiterates himself as the gatekeeper for the sheep. The way into the Father's house is through faith in Jesus. His perfect life was lived for us because we couldn't do it. His perfect life then was sacrificed because an imperfect life would not suffice to pay the price of redemption or forgiveness. His perfect but dead life was raised to life as the first fruits of our resurrection from the dead. And here's the kicker. Any attempt to know the Father other than through Jesus ultimately fails because imperfect people cannot inherit the kingdom of God without the forgiveness that God offers. Now, is that being non-inclusive? Yeah.
Truth is not inclusive of everything.
Say that again, maybe a little louder.
I said truth is not inclusive of everything.
So, say more.
Truth, by its very nature, is very exclusive.
Yes, because it weeds out untruth.
Anything slightly different is an untruth.
That's correct. And so when the world says, the postmodern world anyway, says there is no such thing as absolute truth, that's their way of trying to get around that feeling of, what if the truth I believe isn't really the truth? Well, it's easier, and frankly, I think the easy way out, is to just say, well, then there isn't any truth.
Or
right?
We each have our own.
Well, it's kind of the same thing, is that relativism says, well, your truth is no better than my truth, and so now we each have our own truth. And you'll see that oftentimes people will say, and they hope to be congratulated by other people on social media. They'll say, I'm finally living my truth. And usually what that means is that the lifestyle that they're choosing is anti-biblical. I'm living my truth. And then 100,000 other people go, oh, we're so glad. Oh, thank you. We're so happy for you. Right?
I've run into a new term that evidently is in the Oxford Dictionary now, and it's called post-truth.
Post-truth?
And what it means is, I don't care if it's true or not. I only rely on my feelings and my preference.
Right.
So truth no longer matters.
Right. So, yeah.
Relative or not, it just doesn't matter.
So we live in a world now where the thinking is that your feelings are more important, your subjective experience is more important than your objective truth. And so you can see where that would lead to chaos, right? Yeah, and immorality. And everybody does their own thing, or everybody does what they think is right in their own minds. Well, that takes us back to the book of Judges in the Old Testament, for those of you that have studied that. You know? That's right. And if I decide what's right in my own minds, and I can get other people that join with me in that, now we have an army or a mob or whatever it is that we think can exert itself on everybody else. Wonderful way to live. Okay. Now, what's interesting about that, if you read the book of Judges, is how did God treat that? Because that was going on in the faith community, by the way. That was going on. That thinking was not just going on among the Canaanites and the pagans. That became the thinking of the faith community as they adopted and accommodated themselves to that culture. So what did God do about it?
Withdrew his protection.
Do what?
He withdrew his protection.
Yes, there was a sequence of that. He would say, well, if that's what you really want in life, then I'll give that over to you, little Romans 1 kind of thing, but I'll give that over to you so you can see what it's truly like to have a life void of Yahweh in your life, okay? And then things would really go downhill for the people of faith. And then what would God do? He brought in a deliverer. He brought in a judge. He brought in somebody that was the prophet, who would come in and speak God's truth and bring the people to repentance, but that process was very painful. Kind of wonder who in this room that would be. Something to think about. Don't you love it when I just sort of do that to you? Yeah. So, see, but the world today would say this is very exclusivistic. What I just said means that I'm saying that Jesus is saying is that the only people that get to go to heaven are people that have faith in Jesus. And as soon as you say that, there'll be a whole raft of questions. Well, what about the people that never heard the gospel? What about the people that were raised another religion? What about the people who you know, were raised Lutheran, Christian, or whatever, and then they fell away? What about all that? And what you're left with is Jesus saying, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Nobody comes to the Father except through me. That's a painful thing to say that to somebody. I've had to do that. Maybe perhaps you have too. That's a painful thing. It hurts to say that. But the reality is that's the truth. And the world we live in today, post-truth, I'll ponder that during the next service. Thank you so much. I'll be thinking about that, yeah. Well, because you think about our service, for example, now that we're doing live streaming, is going out millions of people. This podcast, tens of millions of people, okay? Somebody's going to get offended by this. The truth often does offend, doesn't it? And that's kind of good for us in terms of what we do with it. Yeah, Stephen.
But it's open for everyone. So, even though it is exclusive, anyone can get it, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's the beauty of it.
So it's an inclusive exclusive.
Say that again. That was so profound.
It's an inclusive exclusive.
It's an inclusive exclusive. Yes, that's really good. Yeah, just another thing for me to think about today. I love it. Well, see, since I got my capping question answered, so that's... But, you know, there is no cap on eternity. There you go, right there. Okay, well, let's see. We have a few minutes here, so let's go to the next part. Finally get to the lesson for today, right? So in 14:8 and following, so Philip said to him, to Jesus, Lord, show us the Father, and it is enough for us. Jesus said to him, that it doesn't show up so much in the Greek, but he sighed heavily before he said this. Have I been with you so long, and you still not know me, Philip? Whoever has seen me has seen the Father. How can you say, show us the Father? Do you not believe that I am in the Father, and the Father is in me? The words that I say to you, I do not speak on my own authority, but the Father who dwells in me does his work. Believe me that I am in the Father and the Father is in me, or else at least believe on account of the works themselves. I've been thinking a lot about this. Philip said to him, show us the Father, and it is enough for us. Why did his statement bug Jesus?
Because he already said, the Father sent me,
he has, but what is it about that question that disturbed Jesus enough that he said it again in kind of a exasperated way? Yes, he'd been repeating himself again and again and again, and he goes, oh, come on, Philip, haven't you been listening to me? That would be that. Okay, let me get Kathy and then Philip.
I think he would be really frustrated. I mean, he's been with these guys for three years that they should be questioning. But then go back to Thomas, when Thomas insisted upon putting his hands and took his wounds, Jesus said, blessed are those who believe and have not seen this.
Yeah.
So he would be really frustrated with these guys.
So, like, but as a guy, I could kind of relate. You know, I'm thinking, it took me longer than 3.5 years to really sort of get what being married was. You know?
Jesus, this is God.
Well, I know, but, you know, when you're with somebody all the time and you sort of see what they do and you think, oh, yeah, that's really great, oh, that's a miracle, and that kind of thing. I mean, you're wowed by it, but at the same time, you're a guy, and what does a guy do when he hears the same thing again and again and again from the same person who keeps saying it again and again and again? What's a guy do? The guy's brain says, I already heard this, and click, tune out, and tune off, right? And then, or you're just not getting the full thing of it, right? So I do hear what you're saying, totally. Phil?
It's because God was standing right in front of him. He was literally right in front of him. I mean, like, all the signs and things that he went through, that Jesus performed. I mean, you know, feeding the 5,000, walking on water.
Yes.
God was literally right in front of him, and he still did not see him.
So see, Philip's a guy. And it can be right in front of his face, and he doesn't see it.
And I want to add on to it. In true fashion, I have this conversation with my wife so many times. I'm asking her, where is the garlic powder, whatever? And she says, oh, it's in the pantry. And I'm literally looking right at it, but I can't see it until she comes and finds it for me right in front of my face.
So he's a guy.
Guys, why
your
parents
name
Reveal?
Thinkers.
What?
Guys are concrete thinkers.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, because we're made of dirt. I mean, isn't that right? We're made of dirt. And see, women are made of stem cells, and so that's way more complex than dirt. And that makes perfect sense. Okay, we're hitting it, but I think there's a deeper thing here that's bothering Jesus. It's in that word enough.
Would there have been anything here that Jesus would have thought These guys aren't going to make it very
right. Yes, yes. Jesus was totally aware that if nothing else happens after he leaves, that the kingdom will die right there with those 12 because they didn't get it. Now, John maybe was a little bit more of a deep thinker, but even then, you know, these are guys, and that was it. So what, and we'll see it in the lesson that we'll get to 3 weeks from now, okay, is what did Jesus say he was going to do, or what would the Father do after Jesus ascended into heaven? He would do what? Send the helper. The helper. Yes, the interpreter, the explainer of all things. In fact, Jesus says that. He says, what I'm doing now, remember when he was washing their feet and he goes, you know what I'm doing now, you're not going to get it. But later, when the helper comes, he will explain everything. Okay? And so the Holy Spirit was the big explainer and the recaller of memories so that they would be able to recall. See, that's why they didn't have to worry about, now what is it that Jesus said? Gosh, what is it he said? I can't remember what it was. Okay? It's like, where's the garlic powder? I don't know where it is. See, he didn't have to worry about that. Now, maybe if you pray for the Holy Spirit to come fill to your house, and then maybe, in the moment when you're looking in the pantry, okay?
God gave him his wife.
Well, as the helper, yes. Which, by the way, and this will be a great way to close because we're never going to get to this anyway, okay? In the Bible, it talks about the wife as being the helpmeet in Genesis. I will make a helper fit for him. A lot of people look at that and say, oh, that's degrading to women because she is in the lesser position. But when you look at the word helper in the Bible, guess who is the helper? The Holy Spirit, the third person in the Trinity, is the helper. So we should never think to ourselves that the helper is lesser. The helper is actually more powerful than the helpee.
I found that to be true.
Yeah. So I have to tell you a little funny story and then we'll end. So a month and a half ago, I did a wedding for my nephew in Fort Worth. His name is Jack. He's the last of that brood to get married. Married a great girl. Oh my gosh, she's so awesome. So anyway, I did the premarital counseling for them. And during the course of the premarital counseling, we were talking about the fact that Jack has been a bachelor for a long time. And he was having a little bit of a difficult time adjusting to the new way that things would be. Because he had been used to kind of how he had always wanted things to be and thought, and it makes perfect sense, he thought that after they get married, his way of doing things would still be the way that things would be, right? And so I was trying to explain to him, this is a life change for you. You're just, the sooner that you can figure out, yes, dear, the better your life will be. It's like kind of all those things I usually say. So anyway, I text him every 2 weeks. How's it going? Checking in. You guys still like each other? That sort of stuff, right? And so he texted me back a couple days ago, and he goes, I've learned it. Jackie, that's her name. Jackie is the boss. There you go. I said, man, you got it. We don't have to do any more work together because you figured it out. All right, let's close with prayer. Heavenly Father, thank you for our time together. Thank you. Oh, Lord, thank you so much that you have the loving heart and you just keep on loving us. We can be really tough to love at times. Sometimes we're easy to love, but there's a lot of times when we just don't get it. We our lives get filled with stuff. Our lives get filled with worries, the anxieties of all the stuff going on in the world, and it just sort of fills us up and then at some point kind of numbs us out. Thank you so much, Lord, for loving us here today, loving those that are listening to the podcast today. We just simply would pray that you would keep reminding us of that. We really need to hear that over and over and over again. But even as we hear it, Lord, inspire us and move us to look around us and sort of take the blinders off and kind of see where are the people around us that we also have the opportunity to keep on loving. help us know that the dependent ability to do that, or the power to do that, is not rest in us. It's your grace. And so help us draw on that grace and know that grace is available as it is for us and as it is for each other. So watch over us this day, dear Lord, and the rest of this week until we're together again. And we pray that in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Messiah's Upper Room. Here at Messiah Lutheran Church, our mission statement is sharing His light. That means sharing the light that is Jesus Christ and telling others about His gospel. If you want to join us in that mission, please share this podcast with someone that may want to come and better know the light of Jesus. Use one of our past episodes as a starting point to start a discussion with someone, or use a past series as a personal Bible study or devotional for your family or small group. If we've given any value to you at all, consider leaving this podcast a rating and review on iTunes. That will help us climb the iTunes rankings so we may better spread the reassuring good news of Jesus Christ and continue to share His light with anyone willing to listen. Thank you again so much for listening, and until next time, may God bless you throughout your week. Bye.